Hi, everybody. Today is Wednesday, June 25th, 2025. And we have Alistair Crook, former British diplomat, joining us to talk about what's going on in the Middle East and the foreign policy of the United States. Welcome, Alistair.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here with you.
I want to start with what has happened between Iran and Israel. Somehow, it was a very bright red line when it comes to the way that the two countries try to avoid some, or I would say Iran tried to avoid the war with Israel or the United States. But after all, Netanyahu has decided to go to war. The end game of Netanyahu came to somehow to some sort of achievement by the green light from the Trump administration. When I want to talk about the ceasefire and what's going on right now between Iran and Israel. But before getting there, what has happened in the initial moment in those on Friday that Israel, June 13th, that Israel has decided to go to wage a war, to go against Iran? What's your understanding on the decision on the part of the United States and Israel, what they wanted to achieve?
Well, first of all, the decision to go to war with Iran was made much earlier by Israel. Probably they say, and this is the Israelis who say, probably by September, October. So they were preparing for months for the June the 13th attack, many months, because they were inserting cells, sabotage groups into Iran through this very extended borders across and preparing them together with dismantled drones, which were then put together. So what was the purpose? Well, first of all, it was a deceptional attempt. Deception attempt in the sense that the White House played along with Israel in deceiving the Iranians, thinking that there was going to be negotiations would continue with Witkoff and his team on the Sunday. And Friday was the day of the Israeli attack. And so the aim was to take Iran completely by surprise. So I think you can conclude much of what we saw with the idea that there was a sort of talk between Trump and Netanyahu and the promises that, you know, that there would be no military action by Israel during the talks was all a part of a deceit, was all a ruse to create surprise. And then what happened, because as you probably felt at the time, you know, a few days earlier, some days earlier, I mean, what happened? We were suddenly at war. It took everyone, you know, everyone was thinking, you know, what's going on? We're suddenly, you know, it seems America and Israel are about, you know, and Iran are going to go to war. And we had no great sense of this, you know, beforehand. And it took people, I think, a bit by surprise. But that again was part of the deceit, because what we'd seen in the IAEA, that is the international agency that supervises the nuclear file, which under Grossi, who's the director general, what we saw was a sudden last minute buildup, which took place first on the 6th of June, but ultimately on the 12th of June. And what was it? It was largely generated or triggered by the AI, the artificial intelligence system that is used by IAEA. And the system is quite interesting. It's called Mosaic, but it belongs to Palantir. You might have heard of Palantir. It is originally conceived in order for counter-terrorist insurgency fighting. So what it does is it doesn't actually, you know, look at facts on the ground. It actually projects and infers and imputes motive to people on the basis of what? Things like what social platform they go on, how they dress, who their circle of friends are, what is the pattern of their telephone calls, and so on. And that's how it works. I remember in Iraq, I was astonished at one point when the Americans were targeting people using this. They used it in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's used, of course, in Gaza. That is another, I don't know if it's exactly that program, but another program from Palantir that works quite closely with the 8200 organization in Israel, was the one that was sort of selecting Palestinians for assassination based on, you know, whether their son's WhatsApp group was playing football with Hamas members or whatever. So this suddenly came up, and it suggested a huge acceleration in the Iranian program, imputed, inferred from 400 million data points of all sorts, as I say, of those. And that seemed to suggest that there was a sudden acceleration. And then on the 12th, the day before, the IEA, if you like, agreed a resolution condemning Iran and saying it was in breach of the JCPOA, the nuclear deal dating back to 2015. So this was the pretext for the next day. The pretext was given to Israel by the IEA with the compliance of the board, including particularly the European three, who had already promised at that point to try and raise a resolution for snapback sanctions against Iran. And the other part of this thing, of course, is that this artificial intelligence targeting mechanism was actually being informed to the Israelis. The Iranians have got direct intelligence that much of the data was being passed by Grossi to Israeli Mossad officials. And therefore, the thing was being managed, if you like. This whole thing was being managed, and the pretext given for, if you like, this attack. Now, did Trump know this? Did the American team know this? I have no evidence, but it seems very likely that since this was going on for months and being coordinated with the United States, and of course, all that talk about, you know, that he was stopping Netanyahu, he spoke toughly, there was an argument with Netanyahu. It turns out it was nonsense, because it was all, you know, this whole thing, the pretext was conceived in the IEA, the pretext was handed to Israel, and then Israel did its attack. And I think, if you like, to a certain extent, I don't know whether Trump directly or his team were somewhat suckered in by this presentation of AI to suggest that there was a sudden, immediate, and Iran was very close, therefore, to the possibility of making a weapon. Now, what was interesting was, you know, that when I say pulled in or suckered, I'm saying that, you know, what we saw was that he stuck completely with that line that, no, it was, they're very quick. I mean, they're speeding towards a bomb. And he dismissed Tulsi Gabbard and her, if you like, compilation from the main intelligence services, said there's no evidence of this, and it's agreed with the Europeans and all of the other sort of Five Eyes states. We have no evidence of moving it, no evidence of a change in the Supreme Leader's fatwa about a nuclear weapon, and that was dismissed. But the difference between the two is Tulsi Gabbard's was based on evidence. It was evidence-based. I mean, solid intelligence, which had to be checked and had to be made sure it was accurate and not false, against an AI system, Mosaic, which was saying something very different. Now, was that discrepancy addressed? It seems not, because Gabbard was actually excluded from all of the discussions about Iran when it came up to it. Then what happened on the time, and this is really important because, again, it's now very clear that this was a pattern, and the pattern we're seeing, I think we're going to see more of this, but this was a pattern. The decapitation of the senior military line commanders of the military, who were meeting in a room to plan an exercise, which was advertised, in which Israel would have known about it, a naval exercise, I think it was. So most of the leaders were there, and they were taken out in the room. I can't remember exactly how many it was now, but I think it's about 12 now been either killed in that room or subsequently. And then there was the assassinations, parallel assassinations of Iranian scientists who were killed in their home with their families, targeted for being involved in the nuclear program in some way. Then the other parts to this complex was a complex operation, all in one day, was first of all disabling the air defenses in the central and the western part of Iran, the neighbor of Syria and Iraq. I always get my left and right in the wrong way around. But in the area close to Syria and Iraq, which was where they were.
Khuzestan. It's called Khuzestan.
Yeah, Khuzestan. There. And they disabled this, and they used electronic warfare. It looks as if it was some form of cyber attack. And it took out the system. It was restored after about 8 hours, but during that period, it was disabled. But the intent of all of this and the background, which needs to be understood, was the idea was that the shock, the sudden shock of the decapitation, the assassination, the evidence that Israel could just kill A, B, C, D, E, F, and so on in single strikes to their home and so on, coupled with the loss of the air defense system, which was taken down. All of this would provoke the collapse of the state, of the entire state, would paralyze it, it would demoralize it, people wouldn't know what to do, there would be mayhem, and the state would collapse. And the model for this was Hezbollah, the decapitation strike on Hezbollah, and also the sense, very much the American neocons have been very much taken by what happened in Syria, in the way in which with Syria, with at one moment when Assad left Syria, really Syria imploded. I mean, it just fell apart. I know Syria a bit, and it was a shock to me how quickly it was. But they were full of this and believed that Iran would just collapse like a house of cards on the first day. And that then, you know, there would be a color revolution, and that's why they infiltrated the groups to do, you know, the standard thing, car bombs, disruption of civil life, blowing up the press and information services, and so the state couldn't recuperate, to create a sense of chaos amongst the Iranian people, they thought, which lead, and that's why they kept talking about, capitulation, I'm waiting for surrender, complete surrender, because they thought this, they believed, and Trump believed, and I think Israel believed, that this would bring about complete surrender the states of Iran. And then what happened was just the opposite. Iran rebounded very quickly. It restored the air defense system within 8 hours, got it back, restored the whole system that had been damaged by this process. And then it rebounded, new people were appointed to the military, and it moved smoothly towards the next stage, which was confronting Israel militarily. And of course, there were occasions with, you know, the drones were being fired from within, mostly within Iran. Some of them being fired from up in the Caspian direction from Azerbaijan, where the Israelis have a base. And these were different drones. These were drones with which were attack drones, which were capable of direct, if you like, bombing of infrastructure. So most of what we saw, in fact, was not after the first 8 hours, or at least, but even before. We weren't seeing Israeli, there was no footage of Israeli aircraft over Iran at this time. What we do see is parts of sort of rocket stages and booster stages of Israeli rockets like the Sparrow rocket lying in Iraq and Syria. And it looks as if the Israelis mostly did standoff attacks, launched attacks, standoff attacks in that way against Iran. And then they were using, first of all, the drones that were being assembled by the infiltrated terror cells. Some of it was just car bombings and simple attacks, but some of that was attacks on the air defense system. And as I say, the other element, and so what we see of videos, mostly of videos from these quite heavy, big drones. Iran has shot down three of them at various times that were over. And we don't really have any sort of evidence. You know, the Israel and America talks blithely that, you know, there's no air defenses. Iran is just open, you know, it is defenseless and we can go. Just not true. It's just another one of the deceptions that we have of these many deceptions that have taken place to hoodwink the American and European public and the Israeli public too. So that was the background to the actual, as far as, you know, one can piece it together. I can't vouch for all of it because I wasn't there, but that seems to me to be a rough scenario of what happened up until then, the second day when everything kicked into the war mode, into the missiles started flying and we were into a war mode.
And when we came to a war mode, as you mentioned, how everything was somehow getting to this sort of moment, what has happened during the war? 12 days of war between the two countries. They have never fought against each other directly before. And suddenly we see Donald Trump coming out and saying that we have a ceasefire, we're going to have a ceasefire between Iran and Israel. What has happened during these days of fighting each other that brought this sort of idea to the Trump administration that plan, as you mentioned, was not working and they have to find other solutions?
Well, first of all, the collapse of the state didn't happen. And that was the most important element that we're talking about. I think the second element was the decision taken by Trump to do an attack on these three nuclear sites, Isfahan, Natanz, and Fordo. And that, again, seems to have been long planned. It's not something that came out of the blue, it seems to be, and that's what the American officials also say, that it had been quite long planned. Now, what happened was that I have been told, and I think it's true, that the Trump administration gave forewarning to Iran of this attack, probably through the Russians or through the Swiss embassy, I don't know. But they gave forewarning that this attack was coming, and that I think that I don't have evidence for this, I have to say, but it is my supposition is that the Russian advice to Iran was, it's Trump says it's once and done. They just want to do this and then it's over. It'll be the attack, finish. And the Russians said, just let it happen. You know, don't try and stop it. There's no point. Just let it happen. It's better just to let it go. And so Iran let it go. I mean, there was almost no indication of air defenses or guns firing or anything during attack on Sunday on the three sites. It's still highly controversial exactly what was hit and what wasn't. I think there's considerable doubt whether actually B-2 bombers flew over, but they may well have done. But there is no indication. There's no indication that any serious damage was done to any of those three sites. We also saw that for 4 days before this American attack, Iran was busy filling the entrances with soil. There were long lines of trucks going up, soil was being placed in the entrances. And I think this was done not really to block it off, but to limit, to cushion and to absorb any explosions that take place at the time, because soilers are very good. But we have, three neat holes on one ridge and three or two visible ones on another ridge, which is supposed to be under the ridges that the main holes of the centrifuges lie. Now, I'm not an expert in this, but the experts that I listen to on this say this is not consistent with a GBU-57 bomb being dropped, because if they wanted to go down, you wouldn't have three separate, penetrations of the ridge. You'd have one into which they drop a second and a third or however many bombs, so that they went down and down and down. And that didn't happen. And so the general view, now confirmed, I think, the CNN and the Americans, there's in this reporting just before I came on, I saw, the top secret reports say there was very little damage done to Fordo. I mean, we know pretty clearly almost nothing was done to Nantes. I mean, Nantes had already been damaged by the Israeli buzz on the surface, but not done at, I think the centrifuges are between probably 60 and 80 meters below the upper structure of Nantes. Nantes is an old structure, and Isfahan too was not really damaged. So Trump has gone all out on the Americans. Absolutely obliterated Fordo, the whole program, these three strikes have completely, absolute success, brilliant work by the Air Force, the American Air Force. I mean, that's the end of the program. And he was even hinting, now is the time for Iran to surrender and write, we'll have a meeting and you can write your sign on a surrender document. And this is a narrative which really actually doesn't seem to be working very well. Today, Trump has doubled down on it in the most bizarre way. He says, the Israelis tell me they've sent their people. They've sent people to Fordo and have been in Fordo and have confirmed that it is completely destroyed. I can't believe that his team allows him to say such nonsense. I know that I've been to Qom. In fact, Fordo is quite close to Qom. It's very adjacent. I mean, I know what that area is like. You don't have, you know, Mossad agents wandering around just going into nuclear installations like Fordo, which is remote and, you know, in a mountain, and the entrances to it, you have to go down and down and down and down to get into to the enrichment chambers. I mean, it's just, you know, ridiculous. I don't know why they allow him to say such exaggerated things, because it just, you know, it just undermines everything. So what does this mean? Well, what it means is something important for Iran. I listened, by the way, to the Supreme Leader's address on, I think it was a few days earlier, that he did to a huge gathering of Iranians. And it was translated by AI, as I don't understand it. It was a most impressive address, a very clear statement of Iran, where it is, what it is, very articulate, short, to the point. And the effect on people was really dramatic. But he was very clear, no surrender. He said, we will continue with enrichment. What right has the United States to say anything to us about our proposal? What right have they, unprovoked, illegally, to attack the state? And he said, we will continue with enrichment. We will continue with it because we need it for many things, many different projects that we're engaged with. It was a very powerful speech. And if you haven't seen it, you should. And it had a huge impact on the audience. You could see it. But where are we? So therefore, what we have at the end of this theater, because quite clearly this was theater, the Iranians were informed, they let it happen, they allowed it to bomb, they've said nothing beyond, they've, the United States and Israel say it was a huge victory, we've destroyed the nuclear enrichment program, etc., etc. And the reality is rather different. The reality is that it seems quite possible, that's what the Iranian officials are saying, that the enriched uranium was removed from Fordo some days before this advertised attack. And no one knows where it is. Well, Iran does, but the Americans and the Israelis are saying, where is it? I mean, I read the Iranian, Israeli sort of Hebrew press, and they say, yeah, but where is the 450 kilograms of enriched uranium now? We've lost it. And secondly, what I described at the outset about the sort of the joining of the IEA in a sort of subversion of the program with the Americans and with the Europeans has so discredited the IEA, discredited with Russia and China, I should say, too, not just with the Iranian people, but with both of those states for different reasons, but the same, you know, and still to this day, Grossi hasn't, as I understand it, condemned the attack on a legitimate enrichment process that was being monitored. He has said nothing. Anyway, that means that I think it's now passed through Parliament and through Duma that the IEA is going to be expelled. IAEA will be expelled. They are not allowed to go anywhere. They said not wandering around Bordeaux or Pickaxe Mountain Range to look if it's been hidden there. I don't think they have any ability to do that. They are waiting there. They're still in Iran, but awaiting expulsion, which I think is inevitable. It's going to come. I don't think Iran perhaps is going to leave the NPT. First of all, it takes about 3 months to leave it. It's not quick. But there may be reasons, there may be merits in keeping it. So therefore, you know, first of all, I mean, they've survived the attacks on the first day. Iran survived the attacks, the decapitation day. They've survived the Trump attack on the Fordo. Not too difficult to survive it because it was more theater than real, perhaps. But then, you know, now they are expelling the IAEA, and where is the enriched uranium? And they also say that they have enough centrifuges that they removed before the attacks. So the object, if that was the object, to destroy the nuclear program, hasn't worked. However, before saying this is a great victory, it isn't, because this was just a pretext. This was pretext, and it's important for people who are watching it to understand. As I say, it was planned long ago, and it was part of the long-term plan to destroy Iran and to destroy the revolution, and particularly to thereby to undermine and weaken Russia, and also to put China's fuel supply, its oil supply, its energy, I mean, security at risk. So it was much more, and it has to be understood in the bigger context. It wasn't just about bombing those sites. It was the bigger context of the absolute determination of the American establishment to keep and to restore, if you like, dollar primacy, trading primacy around the world, because they need to rebalance. The debt is terrible at the moment, and they have a deficit on the capital account, which is bleeding, if you like, out dollars. There's this huge cloud of dollar debt around the world, and they need to reduce that and keep it into balance with the productive capacity of the United States. And so one of the elements of this was the aim was to take control of the Middle East energy and resource supplies so that it could underpin, if you like, the dollar and the American financial system while they try and pull back and reduce the outstanding debt and, if you like, bring manufacturing back to the United States and rebalance the economy. So it has to be seen partly as part of the financial war, as well as the war against Russia. I mean, Iran is a key pivot to the North-South corridor, also now to the East, I mean, the East-West, the Chinese East-West corridor, but also now to the corridor, the train link at least, linking Iran straight through to China. So it's very important in that context. And so what's happened, essentially, that brought about it to a ceasefire was what was happening in Israel. Israel not having succeeded in, you know, destroying the state, in decapitating the Iranian state, and was suffering the missile attacks. And the missile attacks started off with older missiles, drones and others, and then moved up to the advanced missiles. And the advanced missiles were with big warheads, 1.5-ton warheads, and particularly the ultimate one at Beer Sheva was dramatically a hypersonic attack. The Israelis were having less and less success in downing the Iranian missiles, less and less success in downing the Iranian missiles, but they were also using up the air defense interception missiles very fast. They were firing at least two, but sometimes much more, at drones. And of course, Iran was flooding the area with drones as well as with missiles to confuse and to preempt the air defense systems of Israel. They were suffering heavy damages. No one can tell you how much because there's a complete blackout. You're not allowed to photograph. You're not allowed to go to the military sites. You're not allowed to report what's happening. I mean, it's a complete blackout. But there's no doubt that there are many deaths, many, many injuries, and also many people who have been displaced by these attacks. But the other part of it, which is not so much mentioned, because we do see a bit of the damage, because, you know, the Bedouin in the Negev and so on photograph incoming sites, even though they're not allowed to. But the other thing is, Israel is a small country. It has only three ports. Eilat has been bankrupt and has been closed for some months. Haifa has sustained huge damage. It was, you know, the trading port, and this was supposed to be the corridor, the alternative to the east-west corridor, the corridor from India that the Americans were touting that would go through to Europe, for the corridor, and Haifa was to be the, you know, the pivot linking Europe right through to the east. Well, Haifa is not functioning. Haifa also, its refinery was heavily damaged. Apparently will not be operational for at least a month, maybe longer, who knows. And now Ashdod, in this last round of last salvos from Iran, was heavily damaged. I can't say how much because, you know, there is this news blackout. So maybe it's not so severe. Maybe it is severe. We have to find out. But everything was closing down in Israel. It, you know, the place was going dead economically. I think they were desperate. And so it was Israel that was in touch with both Iran and with the United States saying, for God's sake, we need this to stop. I mean, we're desperate for it to stop. So Trump thought that then, you know, I can do one of my famous sort of ceasefires and it'll be a great victory for the United States and for Trump. And so he proposed this. What he did was, it wasn't proposed anything. He just announced a ceasefire at sort of midnight and said it's going to start 3 minutes later. And then it was later and later and later as the night went on. It was very confusing for those of us trying to follow it, whether the ceasefire had started or it hasn't started or whatever. But he just announced it. So the first point people have to understand is it isn't a ceasefire. A ceasefire is something that has a framework, that has agreements, that has, you know, a procedure attached to it so everyone knows what is permitted, what is not permitted. That's a ceasefire. I used to make ceasefires in Palestine. I used to have to create them. So I know how detailed they have to be. You have to anticipate everything. There's none of that. There's no framework. There's no real agreement. It's an end of hostilities, that's all. It's not a ceasefire. It's just a brief end of hostilities. And now it seems to have gone into operation, accompanied by very florid language from Trump about how the world is at peace and the world is grateful to the United States and Trump for his great success in doing this. Is this going to last? Is it going to extend? I think both parties are probably quite tired after these 12 days. So I think it will go for a while. But let's not forget, you know, the nuclear issue was just the pretext. The main issue is to destroy Iran. Why? Why so insistent on that? Is because the pro-Israeli group in the United States and the Israelis themselves both believe that you cannot guarantee that Iran will not be able to enrich and eventually move towards the weapon. There's no guarantee, no perfect guarantee for that, because it's once you have the technical knowledge and the people who have the ability to do this, you can't unlearn something. You know it. So the only way finally to stop any threat, as Trump and Israel would see it, of course not everyone agrees with that at all, but the only way to stop it is regime change and to install a pro-Western puppet into Tehran who would ensure that there was never, ever any threat to Israel whatsoever. So even at the moment we're in a pause, even though we're in a sort of period now, perhaps of drawing back, that the threat hasn't gone away. The threat will, and I would say to any Iranians who might be watching it, if there are any, I would say, first of all, don't relax. Don't assume that this is, you know, it's done and gone, finished. We won, would be a great mistake. You need to build up your defenses. You need to prepare, because it's quite possible this little piece has over, but there may well be another of a different type coming. And I would say also, you know, is it a win for Iran? Clearly, yes, because, you know, the mystique of Israel has been completely broken by Iranian missiles. You know, everyone in the region, at least from the region's point of view, thought that, you know, Israel was unassailable, linked, you know, supported by the United States with the weapons and forces of the United States, couldn't be, you know, it was just couldn't be, it was invulnerable. And now it's quite clearly vulnerable and was at the point of breaking up, because there are lots of pressures inside Israel at the moment. And the question is, you know, what is it, the point? What is it going to do? What was the point of this attack on Iran? Where was it going to take us? Because, you know, what was very clear from Iran was that the whole of the Iranians rallied around the government and around the supreme leader and have come together. And I think second point I would say is, you know, this is an opportunity for Iran. You know, Iran needs to sort of, if you like, re-energize the revolution, to move it, to bring the young people into it. It's not failing, or it hasn't failed, but, you know, I think it's been much diverted by the sense that a deal with the West was possible. And I don't think that people will believe that any longer. I think that, you know, siren voice saying, oh, well, we, you know, the West, we need to do a deal with the West. I think that siren voice is probably stilled. And I think that we will see Iran much more, if you like, tough-minded, hard-nosed about its future and about how to look after itself. But this is an opportunity. And I do think, when I was in Iran recently and I talked to some of the leaders, and I said, you know, what is needed in this period of nihilism, postmodern nihilism, is there needs to be something that lifts, you know, the West and everything out of this very literal thinking, this so-called mechanical rationality, and to take it to a different level of consciousness. That was what happened in the revolution. Wow. And they all said to me, yes, it's so important. And we believe that Iran can play a part, have an intellectual role with Russia and China in this way of working out how the BRICS about Central Asia can, you know, find itself, find what it means to be Asia, and to bring in the various, embrace the various, all the components of Iran, which is a very diverse society, as well as Russia is, to how to find a way of giving meaning to what it is to be Russian, what it is to be Iranian in this new era. So I think it does give an opportunity if it's seized, and doesn't go down the road of hoping to do some sort of deal with America. Perhaps that's good politics. I don't know. Maybe it's good politics to what a famous Russian prime minister called strategic procrastination. I don't know if it is, but I think something definitely has changed in Iran, and the change offers a huge opportunity for Iran to really reinvigorate and redefine itself in a very positive way, and needs to do that because the war is not over. It will just find another way of manifesting itself. So when you look at the bigger picture overall, and then I'll shut up. When you look at the bigger picture, you can see some of the things are very important. The statements by Russia and China were absolutely solidly against the American, Israeli, and European aggression against Iran, illegitimate, illegal, against the charter, against international law, against common morality, etc. Both of them very strong. Now that is going to have huge impact on places where you are and others, I think, you know, in the global south, will this, you know, that Russia and China are standing absolutely squarely about a principle in this respect. So I think that is an important thing. I think Iran has demonstrated very clearly the vulnerability of Israel, and it's also, if you like, punctured the myth of Israeli technical, material superiority, exceptionalism. I don't know what impact that will have within the region, I feel it will have an important impact, but I think it's too soon to really judge that and guess how that is going to turn out. With the United States, you know, it's really more complicated, I think, because as you've probably seen, for the United States, you have there's been a dissonance within the political system. The MAGA populists have been saying quite loudly and clearly, you know, this goes against what we stood for. What, you know, we voted for Trump, no more wars, no more Middle East wars, particularly. And we were on the brink of it, you know, and Iran was firing missiles into Udeid, the military base in Qatar, and it could have taken off and we would be in a major war, and that wasn't what we voted. And there have been strong language coming out of people like Tucker Carlson, Steve Bannon, and others saying, you know, you're getting, I mean, we're moving into the neocon camp with this sort of actions. And more than that, they are saying, and this is very important, they're saying, you know, we are going to war not because it's in American interest, but it is in the interest of another state that is not American. Why would we do this when it was supposed to be America first? So that's having a big impact, I think, on the United States. And I think even if Trump is sort of drifting off into rather bizarre statements and things, this aspect of what's happening within, because this is so important, this is defining moment, because you know, many of the voters that supported Trump at the last election came from the Democratic Party and came to him. There were two reasons. One was the immigration, but the other reason was no forever wars. And at the midterms, they could lose those people. They could go back to the Democrats. And that would mean that the MAGA would lose power for however many for however many years. I mean, it wouldn't be quick. So it's really this breach that it's caused is quite fundamental. And I just don't understand why, the White House engages in these sort of exaggerated claims and, it was perfect, wonderful, we've a complete, victory. And so, I mean, why not, be a little bit more realistic, speaking to your own people? You need to bring your people along. And it's best if you do it and not let them find out that they've been deceived, because that is bad politics, basically. So that's where I think we are sort of globally. Where will America go now? Will it try and take further action against Russia? I think the last thing I would say is, the attack in Iran on the 13th of June was a wake-up call to Russia, China, and many other states. It's a pattern that they saw only weeks earlier in the spider's web attack on their strategic bomber bases, of the insertions of, cells with trucks and containers with a roof that would open, and drones would be remotely launched that would attack their strategic bombers. I mean, hugely dangerous. The fact that it didn't succeed much, in three of the air bases, it didn't work. But the fact that it was tried is a wake-up call, of course, to Russia to say, well, what if it does work? What's going on? What's behind it? What is America and the West planning? Decapitation exercises, other places, even in Russia, China, or somewhere else, the same formula. Is it now the sort of Five Eyes modus operandi for the future, this decapitation, assassination, sabotage, attacks by insurgents? Is this the new future? So, it's brought, a great deal of thinking, because, Russia is more, is configured for conventional war, basically. The old type of war, forces and military attacks, not for this terrorist war that seems to be being promoted as the next generation of Western warfare, in order to preserve its hegemony.
You mentioned the main goal to be a regime change in Iran, and I remember those days in the aftermath of war between Iran and Iraq. The level of unity reminds me the level of what's going on within the society in Iran is something similar to those days. They were totally unified against the enemy. They wanted to defeat the enemy. And as you mentioned, it's not just a problem that people are facing in everyday and in their lives in Iran, but people understand that you're not happy with the some sort of domestic policies, you criticize it. It doesn't mean that you want to change the government, you want to change everything. You want to reform it, you want to make it better. In each and every country, we see this. But to be so much naive to go after a plan to do regime change in Iran is somehow beyond me. I cannot believe that the United States would depend on these sort of rhetorics coming out of the Netanyahu administration, Israelis, and the Israeli lobby in the United States. But you've mentioned it was a wake-up call for Russia and China. Is that going to work for those people in Iran who were trying to do everything, to sacrifice everything in order to negotiate with Americans? We've learned that Russian president in St. Petersburg International Economic Forum said that Iranian didn't ask. We wanted to have a better military relationship with Iranians, but they wanted to negotiate with America, and that's why maybe they didn't decide to do that. And here is what he said. The Iranian didn't ask for help. They want to fight. During the war, he was asked if Russia would help Iran. He said they want to fight alone. They are proud. They want to be self-sufficient. But we will see if they will need help for now. They don't want it for now. But is that going to change in the mind of the decision makers in Iran? Are they going to change their attitude?
It's actually, you haven't mentioned it, but it was the same with China. China was ready to help, and actually I think possibly did help. There have been evidence of a number of large cargo aircraft arriving in Tehran. But the Chinese made the same complaint, and they said, you know, we were ready to help. We offered help, and it was turned down because the government representatives wanted to shift to India, and China and India are not on good terms, so the Chinese dropped it. I mean, I would say, and I'm speaking from a long distance away, but I would guess that this will be seen as a huge strategic mistake on the part of those in the government who both turned down the offer of an agreement. I understand that the relationship between Iran and Russia has not always been that easy, but nonetheless, to deprive your country of air defenses, and which China and Russia will be ready to provide, I think will be seen as a mistake. I think, yes, if providing they approach it in the right way, I don't know, probably yes. I see even this morning that the Iranian president has announced that he wants to reestablish negotiations with the United States to normalize the misunderstandings between the US and Iran. Fine, if there's advantage in doing that, but as long as the negotiators understand, you know, the United States has no real interest in coming to a deal with Iran. They want Iran defeated. I mean, you know, Witkoff said it pretty clearly during an interview with Tucker Carlson. He said, look, you know, he was talking about the new Middle East, and he said, well, Lebanon, you know, I'm sure sooner or later it will normalize with Israel. Syria, well, look, you know, the leader, that's problematic, but, you know, I even believe that he could come into the Abraham Accord. The only problem is Iran, then his support for all these terrorist organizations. And we get rid of that, I mean, it's epic. And we would have the whole Middle East normalized with Israel and the United States. And he called it that. He said it would be epic. And so I think that, you know, that is the, I'm sure he was reflecting Trump's, you know, he's a close friend of Trump, thinking on the thing too. The problem isn't just the nuclear thing, because A, they don't believe it can be resolved satisfactorily without regime change. And secondly, it's about the revolution, about the, if you like, the Shi'i steadfastness and ability to endure suffering and pain in pursuit of a principle and of justice. And the West cannot comprehend suffering or the willingness to experience suffering for an end. So for them, it's just a closed book. They can't understand it. So they think, if you will. But look, after what's happened and after what the Supreme Leader said in that address to the people, I mean, and Witkoff, when he said, you know, well, we're looking to sort of have some negotiations with Iran, just I think yesterday or something, I mean, of course, there can be no enrichment. So what's the point? There can be no enrichment, he said. And I suppose, you know, there will be efforts to persuade him to have limited enrichment, to have a consortium. But, you know, I've been following this for 20 years now, or 2015, not quite. But, I mean, I've been following this now. We've been all through this, shipping out enriched uranium to another country, to Russia. The idea of someone else providing the electoral basis. It doesn't seem that the world has got it. You know, Russia's already done that. There is a reactor that is built by Russia near Bushehr, and they're building two more to provide a power for industry. So what's new? What are they going to change? The only message is, you know, no enrichment, and we must dismantle, Witkoff said, we will go in and we will dismantle what we see. If there are laboratories, we will blow up the laboratories. We'll blow up. I think it was Trump said that, actually, not Witkoff. They said, we will go up and we will, you know, what we can't take, we will blow up and the laboratories will blow up. But it's difficult then. What are they going to do? Kill the scientists? Are they going to blow them up too, just to make sure it's forever? Anyway, maybe Iran will go down the road of talking. There's a long history in Russia and Iran of both fighting and talking at the same time. So maybe that will be the case. But I think they will have to be very careful about the mood of the people, because I think, you know, the mood of the people has been, I mean, the Iranian people has been, you know, really activated, been energized by what's happening. And I'm not sure how they'll react to the, to the idea of, negotiating with the Europeans after they saw the Europeans, how they performed. I mean, you know, promoting talks on the eve of this sneak attack, of which they were clearly well aware in advance that was being launched on Iran. I don't know, you're probably a better judge, or you are a much better judge than I am, about what will be the sort of reaction of the people. But I think it would need to take, there must be some sort of, some thought and consideration being given to that even now, I imagine, in Iran.
When we look at the bigger picture of what's going on between the West and Iran and Russia and China, on the other hand, do you feel that, as you mentioned, Iran and Russia are trying to negotiate, to talk with the United States, at least they're trying to continue the talks, but Donald Trump came to power promising to the base, to those people who voted for him, to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine. He didn't deliver on it. And we have the conflict between Iran and Israel. Nobody knows if it's going to continue, they're going to continue this fight, or we're going to have at the end a ceasefire or a permanent ceasefire between the two parties. Is that, do you see any sort of sign that Donald Trump could achieve some sort of settlement in both in Ukraine and in the Middle East?
No, I just see none. And incidentally, you know, because we focused on, you know, what happened on June the 13th and the deception. But what happened with those Istanbul talks, the attack on the strategic triad of nuclear triad of Russia took place on the day before. Of course, the West knew about it and America knew about it. So, you know, every time we're told that there's going to be, you know, a strategic talk, it was actually the same with Hezbollah. Hassan Nasrallah said Hassan thought he was going to discuss a ceasefire when he was lured into that meeting, in which the leadership of Hezbollah were killed. Always, I mean, the same thing. Every time there's in this recent period, every time we talk about a ceasefire, and anyway, when we talk about a ceasefire, What are you going to negotiate? Is there a basis for negotiation between Iran and the United States on that? Otherwise, if you go into those talks, you're going into what I call an attritional cage, whereby, you know, we know what is a ceasefire means to Israel and America because we see it in Lebanon. It means that Hezbollah is expected to observe a ceasefire, and Israel reserves the right to attack Hezbollah when and where they choose of their own volition. That's a sort of a very unbalanced ceasefire, in my view. And I imagine, and Israel has already said that about Iran. If there's a ceasefire, then we, if a centrifuge moves, if a part of the enrichment continues, we will strike. So it's a strange sort of ceasefire. Again, no rules, no framework, just, you know, one side can determines for itself that it has a freedom of action, but the other side is not going to have freedom of action.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alistair, for being with us today. Great pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Yeah. Hope we can have you again on this podcast. It was a great pleasure. Everybody's thanking you here in the comments. See you soon, I hope.
Thank you very much. All the best. Bye.
All the best. Bye-bye.